Listen to RN On Demand anytime or download your favourite programs from RN Online.
Hi there, I'm Patricia Carvelis and this is RN Drive.
I wasn't going to do Bill Shorten's homework for him. It's for him to actually put out his plan.
The bickering over the budget continues, ditto the debate over company tax cuts, and on Sunday the election is likely to be called. I'll discuss all this with Social Services Minister Christian Porter tonight. Also, women-only train carriages, are they a good idea? You'll hear from someone who's given this quite a bit of thought. That's on at about 25 past six tonight. Then... She's won X Factor. Can she do it again for Australia at the Eurovision Song Contest next weekend? Dami Im is my guest in the drawing room at 7:15 tonight. Stay with me across Australia, online and on your mobile. It's 6:06, and as we reach the end of Budget Week, what a big week it's been. Attention turns to Sunday when the Prime Minister is expected to interrupt Mother's Day get-togethers by calling the election. The budget will, of course, remain a focus of the campaign. Just look at how the debate over company tax cut costings has raged on today. It's even got more explosive. And that's not even a traditional hip pocket issue. So what about the debates over childcare, paid parental leave and welfare? Christian Porter is the Social Services Minister. Welcome back to RN Drive.
Patricia, good to be here.
Just firstly on the issue that's dominated the last few days, if you propose a 10-year plan for tax cuts, should you say up front how much it will cost over the 10 years? I mean, why has it taken so long and now Treasury officials have done it?
Yes, I didn't hear it, but I understood that the figure was given in estimates today of around $49 billion over the 10 years. Look, the position, I think, has been set out ad nauseum over the last couple of days, but Treasury in the budget papers does not do 10-year costings. They do 4-year costings, save with the one notable exception that you have a 10-year global projection of everything, revenue measures, savings measures, so that you can work out what the underlying cash projections are over 10 years. So as it transpires, there's been a large amount of interest in it, and it's been a figure given out in estimates today.
Chris Bowen says the government is playing politics and effectively politicising Treasury on the eve of an election. Here he is this afternoon.
First, we were told the costings didn't exist. Then we were told the costings were really in the budget. They were just hidden a little bit. Then we were told that there was no dollar figure. And today the Treasurer says he knew all along, but he didn't want Bill Shorten to know before his speech. The politicisation of the Treasury has reached a new low.
He makes a decent point, doesn't he, that Treasury officials were put into this position where they had to reveal the figure rather than the government of the day.
I just think that's a wild over-egging of the pudding, to be honest. I mean, look, the real issue here, Patricia, is whether or not this is a good thing for Australia. I unequivocally think that it is. I mean, these company tax cuts, staggered as they are to benefit small business first and heavily, who are massive employers of Australians, will result in 1% uplift in GDP in the long run. And in today's dollars, that's in $16.5 billion worth of uplift in our GDP. And that's more jobs, it's more employment, it's more growth. The central question is that a better option than the alternative being offered by Labor?
On RN Drive, my guest is Christian Porter. He's the Social Services Minister. And, of course, we're about to enter an election campaign. 0418 226 576 is our number. Have you followed this Treasury story? What do you make of Labor's claim? 0418 226 576. The Prime Minister says women hold up half the sky and that increasing workforce participation is a key government priority. So why have you delayed for another year changes to childcare subsidies, which would make it easier for women to go back to work? How does that help with jobs and growth?
Well, so the subsidies are, as you point out, very important. Under the previous government, childcare cost increased by about 50% over 6 years. What we have done is devised a series of reforms to simplify the system, to give better subsidies to people, to make it more affordable. But we have to pay for that through savings in other parts of the budget. We have always been absolutely explicit about that. The reason these have had to be delayed is because Labor will not support us to help pay for them. The way in which we have identified to properly pay for the big reform in childcare is to close down over a number of years the end-of-year supplements that are attach to family tax benefit. These are supplements that were invented in the 1990s to pay for debts that don't arise in the same way they did then. And what we have said from day one is that it is much better to take that money from the end-of-year supplements in FTB, where they're for purposes that are no longer relevant, and move the money into childcare, which does precisely, Patricia, as you note, enlivens women into the workforce.
It does, but what I'm interested in is you're delaying it because you're saying you can't get the other measure through, but your tax cuts for high-income earners, who are mostly men, actually, if you look at the statistics, are not tied to any other cut. So for some groups, you don't create any linkage, but for largely women in work, there is that link. How is that fair?
Well, there aren't tax cuts. I mean, there is the natural end, which was legislated for the budget repair levy, which does sit at the top end of the...
That's right, and it's mostly men.
It's mostly men who are
on those high incomes, Minister.
But it's not proper to call it a tax cut because it's simply a reversion back to what has always been the system.
It's an effective tax cut for those high-income earners who are largely men.
Well, I mean, when the temporary levy was introduced and supported by Labor in legislation, ultimately it was always meant to be temporary. But at that end of the tax spectrum, high-income earners in Australia pay massive amounts of income tax. Now, to leave that levy in place permanently would leave you with a country where the top marginal tax rate was permanently 49%.
Are you saying that if the new Senate, after July 2, if you're in government, if the new Senate doesn't cut family payments, working mums will get nothing, working families, because of course fathers also benefit from this childcare increase, will get nothing?
Well, the present system of subsidies in childcare remains as it does today in the absence of the reforms that we are hoping to bring in. And that is a multi-billion dollar system of subsidies. This would add $3.3 billion to those subsidies. So to say they get nothing is not, again, entirely correct.
But if you do not get the family payments cut, if you're unsuccessful...
The two are linked, Patricia, that is true.
And there's no way of de-linking them if, again, you fail with the new Senate?
Well, our budget approach has been that savings in one area have to be used to underpin spending in another area. Labor's approach is to add $100 billion worth of new taxes to fund new spending. Now, they are two very different approaches, but we have said that with respect to the childcare reforms, which are very important to having women able to enter in greater numbers and in greater hours into the workforce, that has to be paid for. It can't be paid for out of imaginary revenue from elevated estimates of tobacco excise. It has to be paid for from real savings elsewhere in the budget. The savings we've identified are in the closing down in a staggered, slow way over a number of years, the FTB end-of-year supplements, and moving that money to pay for reforms in childcare. And we think that that is ultimately reasonable. We would obviously be putting that to a future parliament. We would hope that a future parliament would see it as reasonable. But we don't want to pay for that uplift through increased taxes or increased borrowings.
You've paused your paid parental leave reforms, although the budget shows you haven't given up on them. You don't subscribe to Tony Abbott's views about double dipping. I mean, that language isn't being used anymore.
So. No, it's unhelpful language, I think, to describe the situation. But there is a challenge.
But you're still pursuing the same agenda. You just dropped the language.
Well, no, there's a problem to fix here. And the problem is that, and our position is that women should get 18 weeks, mums should get 18 weeks paid parental leave. But the problem has arisen where a category of people who presently get access to the full amount of the taxpayer-funded paid parental leave, which is about $11,800, are also high-income earners with very generous provision from their employer for paid parental leave. And what we are simply saying is that 18 weeks should be the minimum amount, and everyone should get 18 weeks, but the people at the high income level shouldn't get the ability to have the taxpayer-funded amount on top, in total, to what they get from their employer. And I think that is a fair approach to the problem. Why should it be that a high income earner should get paid more to have 18 weeks off with their child, much, much more, through a combination of the private employer's amount and the taxpayer's amount? Why should they get much, much more than a low income earner? That doesn't seem to be a very equitable approach.
On RN Drive, my guest is Christian Porter. He's the Social Services Minister, and as of Sunday, he'll be entering a very strong, difficult election campaign if you look at the polling. 0418 226 576. You're taking the carbon tax compensation away from new welfare recipients. So that's a cut to welfare.
well, you can't take something away from a person who hasn't received it. So what we're saying is that everyone who presently gets the carbon tax compensation keeps it. But yes, that,
apart from
that
New Start recipients.
No, anyone who enters the system into the future won't be able to have access to the carbon tax compensation. So everyone who's got it at present keeps it. But if you are a new entrant into the future, you won't be able to access it. Now, that represents around $1.4 billion worth of budget savings.
But do you accept
savings.
Then it's two tiers of welfare recipients?
Well, yes,
the new
I mean,
ones?
Yeah, into the future, there will be a some pensioners, for instance, who will be receiving carbon tax compensation because they've been in the system prior, and there'll be some pensioners into the future who won't be able to access the carbon tax compensation. So I accept that. But what we're asking is this question. Is it reasonable to compensate ourselves into the future for a tax that didn't happen, an electricity price increases that didn't occur, when that money can be redirected into a fund to care for Australians in the greatest level of need, that is those Australians who will be accessing the National Disability Insurance Scheme at full scheme in 1920? And I think it's a reasonable conclusion to draw that that is a reasonable way in which to reallocate the expenditure.
So there are two tiers now of welfare recipients as a result, though?
Not now, but into the future. Well, Patricia, there are many tiers. I mean, we have 20 types of welfare payments in Australia with 55 different categories, sub-payments, add-on supplements. So if the point is that this creates a another layer to the system is so multi-layered at the moment that this is not a deal-breaker to have another layer in the system. But what we've tried to do is find the right balance between...
Well, on that issue, you're right, actually, there are a lot of layers. Why has the government completely squibbed welfare reform? When first elected, Tony Abbott talked about a welfare review, the McClure report delivered its report, and yet the government's done nothing.
I don't think it's entirely true to say we've done nothing. I mean, one of the things...
Close to nothing.
Well, one of the things that we've spoken about, which was the McClure recommendation, was to end end-of-year supplements and FTB. And we're trying to do that, and we're trying to reinvest that money into childcare. There are other supplements that we have gotten rid of. School kids bonus, for instance, that was being paid for and money that was never earned. So we have gone and made difficult and challenging decisions and redirected expenditure, which represented layered add-on complexities in the system in a simpler and fairer way. What we're trying to do with the childcare subsidy is collapse three different types of subsidies into one and make it simpler and more accessible and less inflationary. So we have made efforts. Things have been achieved. There's certainly more work to do in that space because what we do have is an immensely complicated, hard-to-navigate system.
Minister, just one last question. You've estimated a $5 billion annual shortfall in NDIS funding by the time the scheme is fully rolled out in 2020.
Yes.
How many so-called efficiencies will you have to find in other welfare areas to make that up?
Well, we've created an account called the NDIS Special Savings Account, and the idea is that we find savings from across government and place the money in that account to fill that $5 billion gap. We've created $2 billion worth of savings in this budget to place into that fund. So there's more work to be done. But I would say, Patricia, that the purpose of that fund is not just savings inside the welfare system. We can allocate other savings right across government into that fund to pay for the NDIS, which is exactly what we're doing. So likely we will be constantly on the lookout for efficiencies. And whether they're in compliance or debt recovery or other areas inside the welfare system, those funds can be moved into that account. But also it's an account that can receive funds from efficiencies from right across any portfolio.
Minister, many thanks for joining me, and hopefully I can speak to you throughout the election campaign as well.
Look forward to it.
And that's the Social Services Minister, Christian Porter, joining us here on RN Drive on a Friday night. 0418 226 576 is our number. You heard lots of things he had to say there. What do you make of some of the government's plans, which, you know, including with childcare subsidies, really rely on changing or withdrawing some family tax benefit payments, end-of-year supplements? They won't go through with the changes to childcare unless they get the other half. 0418 226 576 is our number. I'd love to get your views on that. You can also tweet us at RN Drive. It's 19 minutes past six. The federal court in Melbourne has ruled in the unsettling case of an African woman known only as S99. S99 is an approved refugee who was raped in the midst of a violent epilepsy seizure on Nauru. The rape left her pregnant, and Australia's Immigration Authority took her to Papua New Guinea for an abortion. But abortion is illegal in PNG, and the woman is now in legal limbo. George Newhouse is the director of the National Justice Project and one of the lawyers representing S99, and he joins me now. George, thanks for your time on a Friday evening. Tell us about the verdict today. We've just heard you've had a victory, but there are still issues to be decided with the court currently in session. Can you explain?
Yes, that's correct, Patricia. The court has found that the minister does have a duty of care to this vulnerable woman, who was, as you say, raped either during or after a seizure. It's clear she needs a termination as a result. And the judge has found that it would be unsafe for her to have that termination in a place where terminations are most likely illegal for her, and also where the level of care that's required in her complex case, she has neurological and gynecological complications, require her to be treated in a place with a certain standard of care that's not found either on Nauru or in PNG.
What can you tell us about S99? How is she doing at the moment?
Well, I can't tell you that much. S99 is subject to certain non-publication orders, but she's in Port Moresby and she's desperately anxious about her circumstances. Her life is totally controlled by the minister and his departmental officers. She's desperate to resolve this awful situation, and she's, as you say, hanging in limbo. However, the court has made it clear that the minister must provide her with this termination in a safe and lawful place.
So what happens next?
Well, that really is a matter for the minister. The way our legislation is constructed, there's no way that the court could actually order the minister to take this poor woman to Australia and have the termination in Australia where it could be done safely. It really is a matter for the minister, but he has choices. He could, for example, take her to New Zealand or Singapore if the policy of never bringing anyone from Nauru to Australia applies to her. He has various choices, but obviously having the termination in a safe hospital in Australia would be the most appropriate for her.
The court reportedly heard that five separate medical experts advised the government that S99's abortion procedure should be carried out in Australia. What reasons did IHMS or the government give for ignoring that advice?
Well, that's a very interesting point. IHMS actually supported all of our experts and recommended to the minister that the woman have the termination in Australia. It was only that there is a doctor in New Guinea who says that he can do it that formed the basis of the minister's decision. So against the advice of IHMS, the government's own doctors, against the advice of five teaching specialists in Australia, the minister chose instead to follow the advice of a doctor in New Guinea without the requisite qualifications who said that it was possible to perform the termination in New Guinea.
So is there any evidence that the government knowingly risked this woman's health to preserve the policy that refugees should not step foot in Australia?
Well, I think people will have to form their own opinion. The evidence is that it is unsafe and probably illegal for her to have the termination in Port Moresby. But against all that information, a decision was made from within the Department of Immigration by someone without medical training, without legal training, who put this woman's life at risk. So you've seen on Four Corners the way decisions made by doctors and recommendations made by doctors are being delayed or ignored by public servants, and in many ways that's what's happening in this case. You have a situation where doctors have said it's not safe, but bureaucrats are making decisions about young women's lives and putting them at risk.
If you're just tuning in to RN Drive, I'm Patricia Carvelis, and my guest tonight is George Newhouse. He's the director of the National Justice Project and the lawyer for S99. A number of other stories relating to Australia's asylum processes have emerged this week. We've learnt today, for instance, that the government will provide compensation to Save the Children workers who were falsely accused of fabricating stories of abuse on Nauru and also encouraging asylum seekers to self-harm. Is this welcome news to you?
I think it is. Those young Save the Children workers were simply doing their job, showing compassion and caring for people on the island. There is no evidence to support the claims that were made, and that's obvious from the apology that was made to them today the compensation that was paid to them today. And I think it shows, though, a deeper problem. Every time there is a crisis or an issue that arises in Australia's immigration detention system, someone else is to blame. You blame the advocates. You blame Save the Children. You blame other people, everyone else except the people who are truly responsible. And I'm very pleased to see that those young Save the Children workers have been vindicated.
The legal status of the Manus Island Detention Centre has also been called into question this past week. How do you foresee this outcome turning out? What do you think is going to happen here, particularly given, of course, these 750 refugees have taken their case to the High Court?
Well, that is a very interesting turn of events. What you've seen is the Papua New Guinea Supreme Court declaring that the Manus Island facility is unlawful and unconstitutional. And how ironic that our former colony has more robust human rights than Australia. I think the minister's options are quite limited now. He's either got to find a third country to place these detainees or refugees. He can't really bring them to Nauru. It's a failed state and it's obviously unsafe, as we've seen. He could bring them here, but there's a political... he's got political reasons not to do so. And at the moment, what he's done is he's leaving them in PNG and saying to the government of PNG that they're their problem. It's really an unsatisfactory state of affairs, and the minister needs to bite the bullet and do something with these poor people.
George Newhouse, thanks for joining me tonight.
Thanks, Patricia.
That's George Newhouse. He's the director of the National Justice Project and the lawyer for S99. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvalis on your radio tonight till 7:30. 0418-226-576 is our number if you want to text us and join the conversation. A little earlier, I spoke to Christian Porter, who is the Social Services Minister, about a number of issues. You probably heard that long ongoing issue that's been dominating the last couple of days about Treasury forecasts for how much that company tax cut will cost over a 10-year period. Finally, the number's been supplied. Now Labor's saying that the government's made Treasury, politicised Treasury on the eve of an election. What do you think? Have they? Or have they just been doing their job? Is it sort of satisfactory the way that this has happened? 0418-226-576.
You're a passionate young scientist and you want to make an impact, so do listen. RN's Top 5 Under 40 is on again. RN and the University of New South Wales are looking for you. Here's your chance to put your work on the global stage. So join us at the ABC to try some radio and television. If you're under 40 and have a good story to tell, look for Top 5 Under 40 on the RN homepage.
Yep, we got Cyndi Lauper on RN Drive on a Friday. I'm happy. And according to Cyndi Lauper, girls just want to have fun. It's so obvious. But do they also want to have, or should they have, their own train carriages or their own parking spaces? Australia's Rail, Tram and Bus Union recently suggested that women-only train carriages would be a good way to keep women safe. What do you think? Should women have their own train carriages, their own parking spots, their own spaces to keep them safe? Is that a way of dealing with safety issues? 0418-226-576. I'd love it if you could join the conversation on whether that is a good idea. Well, Gabrielle Jackson is the opinion editor at The Guardian Australia. She begs to differ, so that's why I'd like to hear your views too. Gabrielle, hello.
Hi, Patricia.
Why do you think women-only train carriages aren't a very good idea?
I have one really big problem with this idea. It acknowledges that there's a problem with women not being safe on public transport. And instead of asking the men who harass them to change their behaviour, once again we're asking women to change their behaviour in order to feel safe. By locking women away in their own carriage, it does nothing to change the problem that exists. And, you know, I think that women definitely have a right to feel safe, and So I you know, think that the idea of a safety carriage is a great one, but it should be available to all vulnerable people. There are other people vulnerable in society other than women. You know, the young trans people, young gay men and women are also really vulnerable to violence on public transport and in public places. So why don't they deserve the right for a safety carriage as well?
So are you against
against sex segregation? I think it's so regressive. And I think also by saying we're just going to put women away in this space is so regressive, and it entrenches this idea that women need the protection of men all the time. We don't need men to protect us. We need them to respect us.
So let me just play devil's advocate here. I actually, I have not formed a view, so I'm just playing advocate.
Let me convince you.
Yeah, let's see if you can. Let's see if you can convince the audience. They're much more important. 0418-226-576. Come on, guys, text in. But, you know, you're sort of painting a picture of the utopian world, and it's a world I'd love to live in too. Let's get that straight. I reckon all of our listeners would agree, which is that women should be safe. But clearly they're not, if you look at the statistics and the facts. So given that they're not yet safe, isn't this a way to kind of create a safe space on the journey to that perfect world?
The statistics show that women are more likely to be subject to violent assault from someone they know than a stranger. So let's just get that clear. And as I said, I'm not against a safe carriage. I just don't know why it only has to be for women, and we have to leave the other vulnerable people out there to face the criminals alone. I think that we need to, we've had so many successful behaviour change programs in this country. You know, slip, slop, slap. We've had, you know, littering campaigns are still going on. Why can't we have a public campaign that educates the men who harass, who say, smile, darling? You know, the things that happen to women on public transport every day are those at that level. They're harassing, you know, some of them get physical. And we should be putting all our efforts into changing that, into making sure that doesn't happen. You know, we have dogs, sniffer dogs on trains to, you know, stop our drug problem. Why can't we put that level of effort into patrolling the trains to stop the harassment of women?
Perth is also trialling so-called pink parking places. I didn't know about this. This is really interesting. They're reserved for women. I suspect you'd argue that that's just a Band-Aid solution, or you're not in favour of that either.
Yeah, I mean, and they've coloured them pink. I mean, it's just so patronising. And you know what else? In some countries where they've introduced these pink parking spaces, they've also made the bays wider. And I just think, you know, can you imagine all the women driving jokes that are coming out of that? That feels to me that the people who come up with these great policy ideas aren't really coming up with solutions. They're just like, let's just stop women complaining for a little while and come up with this kind of thing, this Band-Aid solution. And my real concern is if we, you know, paint a few car parks pink and put some lights in those few car parks, then if a woman parks somewhere else or gets on the other carriage and she is assaulted or the victim of a crime, the answer is going to be, but why didn't you park in the pink place? Why didn't you get on the pink carriage? And once again, women are being blamed for crimes committed against them. This just doesn't seem like a sound solution to any of the problems that we're talking about.
Yeah, and there's also this women-only ride-sharing app we recently covered on OnDrive. It's called Chariot. Which is a really interesting idea, women drivers, women only, and children I forgot what the age was, about 12 or 13, some sort of, you know, crucial age where apparently, you know,
men suddenly all become violent.
Yeah. Surely an app like this can be potentially a good thing. I mean, when I remember when we first covered it, I thought, well, maybe I would think about doing that. There is times where I've caught an Uber or a taxi where I have felt unsafe.
I think it's such a dangerous precedent to set. I think that every taxi driver and Uber driver should be vetted for their violent potential, and we should live in a society where we can trust that the person we get in that taxi with is going to be safe. I mean, I also think that it creates fear that doesn't actually need to exist. That's not true in every society, certainly, but in Australia, I don't think that we have such a dangerous system and a system where the police don't take our you know, violent crimes against women seriously enough to enable this. I think it further entrenches a problem rather than creates a solution to a problem.
But the fact that something like this exists, Chariot, shows that there is a demand, doesn't it? Because it's a business model. It doesn't exist. It's not sort of, you know, a charity.
There's this making money. Yeah, because it's exploiting the fears of women, and that's a really successful business strategy. There's a phrase in the marketing world called shrink it and pink it, and that's what you do to any product if you want to appeal to women and charge more. And that's what I feel like these policies are. They're saying, here's a solution. Come and use our service so we can make money off your fear. And I just don't. I think that that is a very good solution to the problem.
Gabrielle, thank you so much for joining me. You've made a robust case against segregation. I instinctively am not someone who thinks segregation is ever a particularly useful thing to do anywhere, but it's an interesting concept. Thank you so much. Gabrielle Jackson is the opinion editor at The Guardian Australia. She's written an article about all of this. What do you make of it? Women-only carriages to keep women safe. She makes an interesting point. How about other vulnerable groups, other people who feel like they could be put into a dangerous situation? Should they be also in the carriage? And is that a good idea as well? Then it becomes a, I don't know, minority group's carriage. It seems to me like, well, I don't know, I'm just going to let you actually decide. It's something to ponder. 0418 226 576. What do you make of it? You can also tweet us at RN Drive. And, you know, there's this other thing called our Facebook page too. You can let us know always what you think there too. On RN Drive, I'm getting lots of your text messages about, well, a number of our conversations. If you've missed any of them as you've coming in and out of the car or the tram or the bus or wherever you listen to us, hopefully on your ABC radio app or on your old radio. I spoke to Christian Porter, the Social Services Minister, about a range of issues and got these text messages from you. One says, politicians buy votes with the family bonuses. My mother had nothing like that. Another says, different categories of high income earners. Yeah, some are special, some are not. And also, why not eliminate tax on small businesses altogether? GDP will go through the roof. And on that topic of female-only carriages, I invited you to give me a view. I said I hadn't really decided, although I will. I have half decided. I'm instinctively troubled by segregation like that. Carl writes, more police on the trains are what's needed. Carl, you make a very good point. Police are there to protect us from violence, particularly violent attacks. I reckon that's one view I can't help but agree with. Yeah, you do. That's actually why police are on the streets, to keep us safe. A few other texts here. Women are entitled to feel safe in an enlightened society. If carriages for women only assists in this while opportunistic men are still around, then the proposal is appropriate, says John. Another, hi, Patricia, I agree with your guest. Men need to change, not to look for ways around for us women. Do we want us... my computer just did this weird thing and I lost that. Do we want women Do we want women to get protected like they are in the UAE? God, this has really gotten people excited. Men are in greater need of safety on public transport than women, says one person. And finally, well, there's a lot more, but I have to end somewhere. Gabrielle is spot on. Avoid segregation at all costs. Women will end up being blamed. 0418 226 576. You can tweet us at RN Drive, and of course subscribe to our podcast if you missed that interview. It is really a very provocative conversation, and we certainly have not found a solution to deal with violence.
This week on Radio Tonic, stories of discovery.
When you're climbing up the side of a mountain, your body screams stop and your mind says, well, that's the trick. It's what your mind says.
I was a bit puzzled about what it might mean, and then I Googled it and I got quite a shock as my screen lit up with parts of the anatomy that weren't all that familiar to women 30, 40 years ago.
Storytelling with a twist. That's Radio Tonic, Sunday, 3 p.m, right here on RN.
We need to set our sights higher than just making sure government doesn't screw things up.
I'll give a fair go to all on the floor of this chamber.
Hey, what happened?
The rap.
It's time for the wrap, where we take a look back on the news week, and it hasn't been a small one. What a week. A lot happened. It was only on Monday that Question Time, well, was full of this.
No, we don't want to deal with the carp. We've got to get rid of the carp.
We can't help but play that carp grab. It's just too good. And since then, we've had a budget reply, a debate about housing affordability, offshore detention, budget figures, projections, 10 years, corporate tax cuts. I'm exhausted just thinking about it. Stephanie Anderson is the ABC's political reporter. She joins us. Hi, Stephanie.
Good evening, Patricia.
Also, Jason Potts, Professor of Economics at RMIT and an adjunct fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs. Hello.
Hello.
All right, Jason, let's start with your big story, the 2016 federal budget. But actually, I need to correct myself. It's a national economic statement. It's a plan. It's not just a budget. We've had a few days of distance now, handed out on Tuesday night. The details are starting to be teased out. What was the vibe of the budget for you?
Look, it seems like it was a political budget, very much.
Shocked on the eve of an election.
It's incredible to see it. But it looked a lot like an ALP budget, to be frank about this.
You reckon?
Taxes were up, spending's up, no big plans to tackle the deficit, the public debt's still there. It doesn't
look like really, an ALP budget to you.
It's disappointing from the coalition.
Is it the super tax raid, you'd have to call it,
$6 billion? That's the worst of it. But, you know, it's just overall, there was an opportunity missed here. It could have been a lot bolder. It could have actually tackled some structural reforms. It could have actually been an economic budget rather than a political budget.
But, Jason, is that realistic? We are on the eve of an election. I'm just asking the really pragmatic political question. The Prime Minister's probably going to go to the Governor-General on Sunday. Could he have really had a slash-and-burn budget, your fantasy budget, and won an election?
Not a chance. He's not going to lose any votes
chance.
Over this. It's just disappointing to see.
Stephanie, I want to bring you in here because you'll be covering the election campaign any day now. Is this a usual budget or is it more of a sort of political document like Jason says?
Oh, well, I think even if they've denied that it's a political document, it's very easily seen that the Labor Party is trying to make it out as that. But I'd actually have to agree with Jason here. It is very much an election budget. It's much more voter-friendly than what we've seen in previous years, especially if you compare it to just a few years ago with Joe Hockey's first budget.
Well, it's pretty different to Joe Hockey's. But let's get to what Labor's arguing, because Labor's saying it's really unfair still. So they still want to prosecute the fairness line, Jason. And Stephanie just said it doesn't look much like 2014. Is Labor going to have any success with this fairness line, given...
Look, I can't see any light between them on that. The only thing that was interesting in this budget was the 10 years away possible cut in corporate taxes. I mean, that's interesting and good and possibly the best part of that. And that was the very bit that Labor wanted to attack, the only bit that actually promised some economic reform.
So, Stephanie, then Bill Shorten's budget reply happened last night. I actually was still in Canberra, so I got to watch it in the gallery, which was always good to do, to watch what it looks like rather than just read a speech. Which doesn't quite have the same vibe. What did you make of it?
Look, I think, as I said before, even if this wasn't an election budget, Labor have definitely tried to make it one. You would have heard a lot of grabs like billionaires versus battlers, the big end of town.
I think my favourite actually was gone to Tony's Tradies. It's Malcolm's Millionaires. Did you hear that one?
I think that grab got a lot of runs. It was a zinger-filled budget reply. That is what was lighting up my Twitter feed the other night. I have to admit that. There were some interesting points. I think it was my partner, actually, who pointed out that he was playing to his strong points by bringing up Beaconsfield. And I think that's probably something we're going to see feature in the upcoming election campaign.
Yeah, well, so... instead of being kind of afraid of his trade union past, you think Bill Shorten might actually cultivate it or raise it?
Oh, look, I wouldn't be surprised if I saw him bringing up his, you know, labour for the workers. They've already played to this by taking on the average full-time income. I think we've seen that with the tax breaks that Scott Morrison tried to introduce with the whole bracket creep around the full-time average worker making $80,000. And then Labor coming back saying, well, you're missing out on a whole chunk of the population by putting that there.
So, Jason, I'll bring you back in. Have any sort of smaller budget details caught your attention in particular? Because, of course, some of the big measures we've talked about broadly, super, of course, the company tax cut, they were the big ticket things. But is there any sort of sneaky detail?
Well, it's more what wasn't there, I think, that got me. I mean, the thing that surprised me was, what was it, almost $1 billion to the ATO to prosecute tax avoidance. That's more red tape. Right, that's
big companies not paying tax. Well, most people, you know, you might be in the minority there, mate.
Sorry,
I got to call it out. But I think people want big companies to pay their fair share of tax.
But a lot of the companies they're going after are mobile. They don't have to be in Australia. They can move offshore. And I just they bring a lot of foreign investment in. I think there's a cost to going after them.
Stephanie, have you noticed anything in particular in the National Economic Statement budget plan that isn't getting the attention it deserves? There's a lot of smaller stories.
I think it's more what wasn't there that is getting a lot of attention. I think we've seen Labor go really hard on negative gearing, and that was something in Shorten's reply as well that you would have heard quite a lot of.
So, Stephanie, what do you reckon? You're going to go on the election campaign, is that right?
Indeed, I will actually be manning the live blog for most of the time, so I will be getting very intimate with all of the details of what we're about to see over the coming 8 weeks.
And there's going to be so many words spoken. What's your pick, Stephanie? Who do you think's ahead?
Oh, it might be better to leave that up to people like Jason. I'm basically just going to judge them on slogans. I'm actually
spoken like a true ABC journo there. I'm going to leave that one right there. You're listening to RN Drive. We're wrapping up the Newsweek. My two guests are Stephanie Anderson there, sitting on the fence with ABC News, and Jason Potts, who's also in this studio with me. Our number 0418-226-576. I bet you have a view. Text me your view. Who's ahead? Who's going to win? I'd love to hear it. Jason, is Malcolm going to win?
Look, I haven't seen the betting markets on this, but it looks like he hasn't lost any votes in this with this budget.
So you think this budget?
I think they'll sneak home.
You think they'll sneak home? 8 weeks though, anything could happen.
That's true.
It certainly could. All right, we're going to move on to another story. Stephanie, let's move on to your big story, which is the always very thorny question of Australia's asylum seeker policy. This is Nauru's Border Protection Minister. He'd released this statement on YouTube directed at the asylum seekers who are on Nauru. Here it is.
I want to express on behalf of the government of Nauru and our Nauruan people how deeply saddened and concerned we are by the recent tragic incidents. We want to acknowledge your frustration at where you find yourselves. We are aware that you did not design to come to Nauru. We understand how distressing it must be for time to pass, with few long-term solutions being offered to you.
Stephanie, this is a conciliatory message coming from the Nauru government. How does it compare to sort of the line Australia's been taking on this?
Well, look, it's actually quite interesting because we've seen that, but we've also seen a few statements come out from the Nauruan government who seem to be levelling a bit of blame towards the refugee community there. And we've seen the same thing back here in Australia. Our immigration minister, Peter Dutton, has been obviously having a bit of a busy fortnight with some of the stuff that's been happening, but he has taken aim at advocates who he says are well-intentioned, but maybe advising refugees and asylum seekers to be taking some kind of action. I'm not implying that he's pushing them to these kinds of acts, but there is a level of blame there, and it's actually widened this week to the way that some of the media here actually cover these incidents.
So, Jason, as mentioned, I mean, Immigration Minister Peter Dutton has been passing the blame for the very tragic cases of what we've been seeing on Nauru to refugee advocates and the media. Do you think he's right to single them out, or does that have to be, well, I mean, it has to be based on evidence, surely?
Yeah, of course it does. I mean, this is just tragic and sad, and, you know, there's a problem here. It may well be that the issue is even bigger than this, that we've just got an immigration issue here about how we handle immigration, how we handle people coming into Australia.
The Guardian's reporting today that the asylum seekers who arrived on the Cocos Islands by boat this week appear to have been returned to Sri Lanka by the Australian government. Stephanie, do you know anything more about this? It's operational matter, which means we never find out much of the details. So what do we know?
Well, look, we have sought comment and have been told that there will be none coming, seeing as it is an operational matter. But my colleague at Triple J, Hack Shalila, has been following this, and I believe she was the one that actually broke this story when the boat did arrive. And we believe they have been returned. They've been sent away on plane. It's beginning to seem a lot like a few years ago when we used to get these reports coming in far more frequently with very little information.
We're wrapping up the Newsweek with our guests, Jason Potts and Stephanie Anderson, 0418 226 576. Jason, you say you're concerned about what you're seeing, but you've had some fairly radical proposals for refugee policy. What do you think Australia should actually be doing?
Well, I think just not to separate refugee policy from immigration policy, just to treat this as a single issue. And the basic issue here is could we, under what circumstances could we just open our borders? And there is a possible answer to this. Mm-hmm. Australia has a lot of capital and public goods and so on, and there's always community concern about people taking other people, you know, just coming in and free riding. So what if we put a price on it? If we decide, say, $50,000 is basically your share of Australia's public good, you know, roads, infrastructure, et cetera, and anyone who pays that, subject to some basic background checks, can come in. We don't have
so
a
what
quota.
Are the what happens to the poorest, most desperate asylum seekers under that model? Look, they don't get in.
No, not at all. With this system, what we could do is we
isn't
could,
that just like a skilled migration or a
skilled, well, no, because the skilled migration system is still a quota. It still says this number of people. But what if we have something like HECS, where you have a basically the government would loan you that $50,000 and you can pay it off through taxes over a lifetime, but just anyone can come in if they pay that. And just open borders. This just we would just do away with the refugee problem altogether. And maybe charities could pick up some of this. Maybe family and friends could. But just that you're basically buying your way in, your share of Australia. And I think just some new thinking around this issue could take a lot of the heat out of this sad, tragic situation.
I think we know that is a very, I respect everyone having their own views, but that is a very radical idea. And I cannot, I've been watching politics for a while, I reckon you're going to agree with me here, cannot imagine either side of politics taking that policy on. Stephanie, you watch this pretty closely. Any chance of that?
I'd say it's fairly unlikely. I think the only people that are willing to be flexible on immigration policy at the moment are the people that are actually leaving at this election. I don't know if you've been paying attention to a few of the valedictory speeches that have been going on this week.
Tell us more.
Well, we've seen some quite outspoken people in terms of asylum seeker policy. We would have seen the former Speaker Anna Burke. She was referencing the Nauruan incidents recently, saying that people are so traumatised by our policies that they are setting themselves alight. And I think Melissa Park, who's well known for advocacy in this area, described our offshore processing policy as a festering wound. So there's a lot of commentary from people who aren't actually trying to get re-elected. So it'll be interesting to see what actually comes out of candidates over the next 8 weeks.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Getting a few texts on this stuff. If we need budget repair, why is the government giving tax cuts to business and the rich, says Colin? And from my conversation before on female-only carriages, female-only, hell yes. I loved it when travelling by train in India. Pink, please no. That's so patronising. Okay, so female-only, but no pink. I get that. I got the message there. 0418 226 576. We're going to move to the smaller stories, or the ones that, you know, didn't get a good run, but you guys were interested in. An Australian man named Craig Wright made international news when he did three interviews claiming to be the inventor of the cryptocurrency Bitcoin. Here he is on the BBC earlier this week.
My name's Craig Wright, and I'm about to demonstrate a signing of a message with the public key that is associated with the first transaction ever done on Bitcoin.
This hasn't put the mystery to bed, though. Jason, what happened? Why are you so into this?
Well, it's gotten even further. Like, there was a breaking story just a few hours ago where he was asked to provide some further proof, because it's actually pretty hard to tell whether he was the person. And he's announced that he's not going to do it. So
he refuses to provide the proof.
And he's going to go underground and disappear again. So this whole thing has just become a mystery wrapped in an enigma again. And this is, in the broader scheme of things, this doesn't really matter. But here we've got a situation.
It's your small story and you're arguing for it.
No, but look, here we've got one of quite possibly the 21st century's major technologies. It's as significant as transistors and electricity and the internet. And it's been invented by someone. given to us. There's no patents around it. It's not wrapped up in firms. It's for the people. And it would just be nice to know who did it. We can thank them and say, you know, thank you for doing that amazing thing, whoever you are.
Digital disruptor
whoever you are. And, you know, but whoever it is, it could be many people.
It could be anyone.
It could be aliens for all we know. But they're also sitting on a lot of Bitcoins, which is worth sort of $500 million or something, which I think is...
Yeah, and that line, not strong enough. It's being used by people to say he was lying all along. But could it be the truth? I mean, scrutiny online has been intense this week. How strong do you have to be to handle something like that these days?
Well, it genuinely is hard to tell. I mean, no one else has come forward. There's no other plausible, credible candidates. All we've got is
only person that's put their hand up
is the one. You know,
I can safely tell you it wasn't me.
All right, it wasn't me either. But you know this. It's not often that we have a technology that we know was invented recently by someone and we have no idea who did it.
Do you reckon it is him?
I think it is. I was.
You reckon it's him?
I don't, sort of 65%.
Then why won't he provide the rest of the evidence?
I have no idea. That's part of the mystery here.
It is a mystery. Yes. It's a mystery. Stephanie, your small story takes us back to Canberra.
Sorry, I can't get away from politics today.
I think that we're going to let you get away with that. The Senate's own Twitter account, which, look, most people would know, I regularly reveal how much I love the Senate's Twitter account. Whoever's behind that, I love that person. But the Senate's Twitter account actually broke the photography rules. How did that happen?
Well, it's such an interesting story because it's such an ongoing battle here between our photographers in the press gallery and these Senate rules. Basically, just to fill in people who don't follow it quite so closely.
Which is everyone.
You're only allowed to photograph a senator when they've got the call. So when they're actually standing up and addressing the chamber. And the Senate actually posted, the Senate's Twitter account posted a photo of the Finance Minister, Matthias Cormann, walking into his place into the Senate earlier this week. And as soon as that went on Twitter, anyone that would have followed it would have seen a whole bunch of photographers from here just replying, asking whether this was breaking the rules, how is it allowed? Because obviously, if we break the rules for something like that, we could face getting our pass pulled and, you know, effectively almost losing our jobs. So it's quite interesting to see that they posted that. They were later told it was wrong.
And they withdrew it, didn't they? Yeah.
They took quite a while to delete it, which I think also got on a few people's nerves because it's something that we've had a long campaign here. You would have seen Mike Bowers from The Guardian has been photographing Lego pieces to try and represent it as his sort of protest. And we've got Andrew Mears from Fairfax who just posts black images because... You can't capture the excitement that you see in the House of Reps.
No, you can't. And the senators like to keep under the radar. This is part of the push here. Jason, you also do work with the IPA, the Institute of Public Affairs. This, you must be really outraged about this too.
I am. This is absolutely outrageous. They're our representatives.
Correct, Amanda.
Pay for them to be there. They're acting on our behalf. It would be nice to be able to see what they're doing.
Well, it's a very blatant case. Yeah. I am taking a strong position here of it's really curtailing freedom of speech,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, freedom of expression, freedom of it's a democratic outrage.
It is a democratic, let's call it that. This is a democratic outrage.
And yet, I mean, I'm sure lots of Australians don't know about it. It is the Senate. I don't think it's scrutinised in the same way. Stephanie, do you think that Bowers and all of the people who've been campaigning against this will eventually be successful? Because they did this with the House of Reps and they were eventually successful. Right.
Oh, look, I hope so. They've been making their case for a while now, and I know that I'm talking on the whole freedom of speech element. They've actually gotten one of the former advocates against loosening the rules on side. The libertarian David Leinhelm is now in favour of yes.
<Of course.
laughs> He's all for letting the photography there, and I know some of the more media savvy senators really want to get their photo out there a lot more. So I think this is a battle that they'll win, but it just might take a little longer.
Yeah, look, it's. I think it's clearly an outrage. If you think it's an outrage too, maybe you disagree with us, actually. We are actually in favour of freedom of speech here. 0418 226 576. Jason and Stephanie, you've been excellent guests. Thank you.
Thank Not you. A worry.
And that's ABC political reporter Stephanie Anderson and Jason Potts. He's a professor of economics at RMIT and an adjunct fellow at the Institute of Public Affairs. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis. I'm on your radio till 7:30 tonight, and there's a lot more that's going to be happening in the next half hour. Dion Kagan is going to join me to talk about the week on the internet in my feed. And then Dami Im, she is our big Eurovision hopeful. We want her to win, people. She's in the drawing room tonight, 7:15. So much happening. Time now for the ABC News. Hi there, this is RN Drive. I'm Patricia Carvelis. Coming up at 7:15 tonight, I have the woman of the moment, Dami Im, joining me in the drawing room. She's representing Australia at the Eurovision Song Contest next weekend, and I'm going to see if I can figure out what her strategy is. Thanks also to your texts and messages so far. On the topic of women-only train carriages, Stanley Grayson writes, "Can we have a child-free carriage?" I think this is mostly sarcasm. And Norma Bush says, "How about we just have male-only carriages?" Lots of different ideas there. Next, it's time for some social media highlights with my feed. I'm Patricia Carvelis on RN Drive across Australia online and the Asia Pacific.
Social media.
My guest on my feed this week is Dion Kagan. He's an academic and arts writer specialising in film, theatre, sex and pop culture. And he indulges his interest in all these topics as co-host of the Rereaders podcast. It's a gabfest of sorts. Dion, were you into podcasts before you actually started making one?
Yeah, I was. And it was really my dream to, you know, secretly, not so secretly, do this exactly, this kind of podcast. The Rereaders is a kind of riff on an American podcast called the Slate Culture Gabfest. Mm-hmm. And the founding host, Sam Twyford Moore, who is the former director of the Emerging Writers Festival, who started the Rereaders in Sydney originally, I think was really influenced by that, the format that they have on that podcast. And I've been religiously listening to that one for years. So it was wonderful that I was invited to join him when he restarted that podcast in Melbourne a couple of years ago.
What do you love about making podcasts?
Look, I think for me, it's the opportunity to really, you know, deconstruct, unpack a topic in popular culture, but in a way which is very informal. So I like to think about our podcast as something that's halfway between a kind of chit-chat at a barbecue and a much more kind of considered, presented, you know, conference paper or lecture or perhaps even radio presentation. And to have kind of ideas in process. I mean, I'm talking very specifically about a type of podcast, which is a critical kind of podcast, but not to feel pressured to really present a kind of coherent or really polished set of ideas, just to chat things out.
People don't like that much polished stuff anymore, do they? There's less desire for a polished product.
Well, I think there is the polished product in those narrative podcasts, you know, the This American Lives, you know, which have beautiful sound design and very coherent storytelling and excellent production values. But no, I mean, I do really enjoy a much more sort of casual, chatty experience in my ears.
Yeah, I like a casual experience in my ears too. Let's keep it cash. Let's talk about this. It's a social media platform, unfortunately named because you can't talk about it without being confused, because it's called This. What is
this? Have you heard of this? This is kind of a mixture between a social network and a newsletter. They basically curate a top list of long form or short form reads from the internet for you. You can receive it daily or weekly. So a lot of people do this. In Australia, we've got one that comes from The Monthly called The Shortlist Daily, which I subscribe to. And in America, you've got the Long Reads Weekly. This do it a little bit differently. You can curate it yourself. So what you do is you join the network and then you select the publications or the people that you want to follow based on your own interests. So, for example, I'm interested in recent articles in contemporary literature, so I follow the literary editor of the Chicago Review of Books, and when that person posts a recommendation of, like, the most fabulous thing they've read on the internet that week, that comes up in my kind of personalised shortlist. So I guess it's a way of curating the feed.
An advanced trust model. It's kind of like, it's a trust model, isn't it? It's, I trust you and I rely on what you will recommend.
That's right. I trust your taste. Your taste is similar to mine, and I, you know, bugger the rest of the feed. I can't be bothered.
No, and you're doing the work for me. Do you think all social media would be better if everyone was kind of restricted to one post a day?
Certainly some people should be restricted to, you know, perhaps no posting ever. I mean, I wonder
if... Ban the posting!
I think we've all, you know, kind of gone through the first phase of social media and gotten to this stage where we're better at navigating it. We're better at kind of programming or restricting our feeds. You don't want to see so many photos of cafe lattes. You alter your Facebook feed. So, I mean, I do think that people are savvier and more switched on about the way they use social media networks, the types of networks they're signed up to, so that they can really, I guess, consume the internet a little bit more strategically.
Let's move to Twitter now. Tell me about the Twitter account Magic Realism Bot.
Okay. This is like my absolute favourite thing on Twitter at the moment. Magic Realism Bot is a Twitter account created by an artist called Chris Rodley. He's a Sydney-based specialist in intersections between literature and art. And I think he's a scholar also in social media. And he's created this bot, which is producing every 2 hours a tweet which approximates the story or the narrative arc of a magic realist text. So we're thinking the works of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Borges, Isabel Allende, Umberto Eco, these kinds of structures. And I don't know anything about coding, so I don't know how he's managed to do this. But he's also put a lot of contemporary characters and lingo and phenomenon in. And it just creates these bizarre magic realist plots in 140 characters. I brought some with me.
Here's some we prepared earlier. I love that. I have brought some.
Some of these are just, you know, very kind of inadvertently satirical. So a pop diva falls into a sea filled with the American dream. She drowns. So that's been randomly produced by the bot, but it obviously, you know, is a very kind of provocative idea. A Ferris wheel is diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. An entrepreneur murders a violinist with an unusual weapon. Management consulting. So, I mean, you know, this really depends on your kind of sense of humour, you know, your sense of irony. But I can read these for hours and hours. And they're,
hours and hours. Really?
This is the only Twitter feed that I can literally scroll and scroll and scroll through. It's got 26,000 followers now, and it's kind of endlessly engaging. Yeah, it's like poetry.
It is like poetry. So that's Magic Realism Bot for anyone who missed the beginning of that. Now, you teach gender studies. That's your academic field. Do you and other gender studies academics use social media a lot for discussion, research, you know, raising issues?
There are a lot of Facebook groups, I think, dedicated to, you know, smaller research clusters. Like, for example, I do a little bit of work on digital hookup apps, and there's a group in which we all post the latest news, the latest research, the latest conversations about what's going on in the world of digital sexuality. I think academics are using social media increasingly. There's a social network called academia.edu, which people are increasingly creating profiles on and using to publish their research, often ahead of when it gets officially published.
Oh, so you get academic exclusives from it.
That's right.
That's exciting.
Yeah, academic exclusives.
Sorry, I put it in the journalism prism there. We get excited here when we get things first.
Academia is a very slow, much, much slower publishing
cycle. Oh, I know.
So you can wait, you know, sort of years and years after you've written an article to actually see the light of day.
Dion, it's been so fun talking to you. Thanks for coming in.
It's been a pleasure.
That's Dion Kagan. He's an academic and arts writer specialising in film, theatre, sex and popular culture. He's also the co-host of the Rereaders podcast. You're listening to RN Drive. I'm Patricia Karvelis. Next, it's a very musical drawing room.
It's Budget Week and we don't believe in the politics of envy or class warfare here at RN. On Blueprint for Living this Saturday morning, we're talking about personal chefing. If you had the money, would you have someone come into your home and poach you an egg on a whim? Let's face it, it seems pretty nice. We talk to two chefs with personal chefing experience this Saturday morning at 9 a.m. here on RN.
Hey there, thanks for coming. Take a seat.
It's time to retire to the drawing room.
You might know her as the girl who won the X Factor, or perhaps you're pinning your hopes on her to win Eurovision for Australia. I know I am. I'm talking about Dami Im. She joins me now. Welcome.
Hello.
Are you nervous? Because I really want you to win.
Oh, I am a little bit. It's the biggest thing I've ever done in my career, so I'm a little bit nervous, but I'm more excited than anything.
Absolutely. It's really exciting. Mm. Do you think your experience taking part in a TV competition will help you with Eurovision? I mean, there must be lots of similarities.
Yeah, I think so because, you know, dealing with all the pressure and being judged while you're singing, I guess I'm sort of used to that from X Factor. So, and then all the, you know, press interviews and doing all of that, it's another skill, I think. So, yeah, it's definitely helped.
How about the pressure of representing Australia?
It's
at what is a really international, I mean, they call it Eurovision, but hey, we're part of it. So let's
exactly.
be honest, it's international.
Yeah. It's a big honour, really, to be representing Australia. I mean, you know, my parents are so excited as well. It's a big honour for the family. But, you know, I'm just working hard and I want to make Australians feel proud of me.
What were your thoughts when you were first approached to do this? Tell me about that approach. You must have been rapt mainly.
Yeah. I was driving. I was going somewhere and then I got the call saying I've got the job, you know, representing Australia. And I guess I couldn't believe it. And I thought, are you sure it's been decided or is this just people talking about it? And they said, yep, you're doing it. It's you. So I just, it's hard to describe. I was just like, really? What?
And it's interesting that what you just said, where you couldn't believe that it was you. Why couldn't you believe it was you? Because really, you're pretty awesome. Why wouldn't it be you?
Well, there's, you know, so many great artists in Australia. Guy Sebastian did it last year. You know, for me to be following the footsteps like of Guy, and Guy is just amazing. He's, you know, he's been around a long time and everybody loves him. And just following him, I just felt like, really, like that's such a huge honour. But yeah, that's why I was sort of seeing that it's hard to believe, but it took a while for it to actually sink in. And I think now I'm about to leave quite soon to Sweden. Like I'm starting to feel it more.
Yeah, because it's about to happen.
Yeah, exactly. It took a long time.
So tell me about your relationship with Guy. Have you approached him? Is he helping you at all? Because he's done it. He's given it a go. No doubt he's got some tips.
Yeah, I've asked him.
Of course you have.
And he said that it's when he was doing it, it was so crazy. And he said it's not like anything else he's ever done before, but he said you're gonna have the best time ever, and it's a bit like the Hunger Games of music. So I was like, oh, like
the Hunger Games
Hunger
of Games.
Music. So it sort of means a lot, I guess, like all the countries from the world come together and they kind of had this war, but without, you know, any blood. It's more about like glitter and sequins and music.
No weapons, just glitter. Exactly. I think wouldn't the world be a better place if just glitter sort of replaced weaponry everywhere? I'm sure I'm going to get lots of texts about that comment. Are you a big fan of Eurovision?
I love Eurovision. Yeah, my friend introduced me to it. I went over to a sleepover party when I was in high school and she was watching it and I just said, what is that? That's really, really strange. Why are people doing that on stage? But I thought, well, it's really cool because all these different countries come together and they can sort of do whatever they like. And sometimes it's really weird and funny. Other times, you know, there's really great talent. So I just think it's good, like you have that freedom to do whatever else that you want to do. So I think that's great.
And you can. Have you checked out your competition? I think there's a naked guy performing with a wolf.
Yep.
How will you stack up against that sort of over-the-top hilarious stuff?
Oh, gosh.
Because it is more than music, Eurovision. It's not just belting out a good track, is it?
Well, yeah, I think you start off with the song, but then I guess you can take that in so many directions. So I've had a few months to really think about what I wanted to do. And I think Eurovision, you really need to highlight something that sets you apart. And for me, you know, I think I don't want to go naked. I don't think that's
there you go. Dami has told you she doesn't want to go naked.
No wolves.
It's a good beginning.
Mm-hmm. But I think my strength is just singing well. You know?
Yeah, no.
I just want to show off what I can do.
My strength is the main thing you're meant to be doing with this thing.
Well, you can do a lot of other things. But, I mean, singing. And also, you have to have a really good stage design and costume, and the performance has to be great as well. So I want that to all come together. Mm. The song Sound of Silence is about feeling lonely and feeling the distance between you and your loved one. So
that's
the
song you're going to be performing. We are going to play it in a minute. What do you want us to listen to when we listen to it? What is it about the Sound of Silence that you think makes it special?
I think that the song has this connection. You know, it's about loneliness, but I think it's got this intimacy within the song that I want people to feel. And also I want people to see the performance and see whether everything else that goes on stage really complements and enhances the message behind the song.
Let's hear it. This is Sound of Silence by Dami Im.
Growing tired and weary, brown eyes, trying to feel your love through FaceTime. Symphonies of dreams and highlights, caught up in this crazy fast life. But baby, you're not here with me, and I keep calling, calling, keep calling.
That is a fantastic song. I had that pumped up. I didn't even talk to you the whole time it was on. That's the song that we're hoping will win this year's Eurovision contest, The Sound of Silence by Dami Im, and she joins me now in the drawing room. I know you were originally from South Korea. You came here, I think you were about nine, am I right there, with your family. Yep. What are your first memories of music in Australia?
Oh, when I came, I think the Spice Girls were really in. So I had to buy their album because the kids were doing it, like listening to it. I didn't speak much English, so I played piano, so I was doing more classical music than pop music. But eventually I really fell in love with, you know, the music and Mariah Carey and Whitney Houston and, Spice Girls.
Yeah, the Spice Girls. I was into the Spice Girls too, so there's no shame there. Okay, good, good. Who was your favourite Spice Girl?
Posh.
Yeah.
Posh. Pretty.
Posh has, I was a Jerry Halliwell fan myself. Anyway, I don't know what that says about both of us, Dami, but look, we'll just leave it out there.
People can judge us, whatever.
Now, you've got a whole album of Carpenters covers out too. What's it about the Carpenters? Are you like really into the Carpenters?
Yes, to be honest. My parents used to play the Carpenters songs to me when I was young, and so I sort of knew the songs, but I didn't really know who the band was until I was in my 20s. And then I was doing some gigs, you know, at a small restaurant before I did X Factor. And I used to sing some of their songs, like Close to You, Yesterday Once More, you know, Superstar. And I thought, well, they are such great songs and they're so timeless. I think it's hard to write such great songs like that with such, you know, beautiful structure, lyrics and melody. And plus, you know, I've always, you know, loved just sitting at the piano, playing acoustically and singing just like that without, you know, I mean, I love all the X Factor costumes and all that, but I just like music.
Stripping it back.
Yeah.
And just playing. To what it's meant to be about.
Yes, with the band, you know, with strings, and it's just, that's what I really love doing. So I felt like I need to make an album of the Carpenter songs, and I did.
You did. Mm-hmm. And we're going to play your favourite, I assume, Carpenter song, Close to You. Why is this song so important to you? Why do you love it so much?
This song is just so beautiful, and also it's sort of like a fairy tale song where it's about how beautiful the world is, you're so much in love, everything's going so well. But then when you look at Karen Carpenter, who sung this, like, she looked like she was having this perfect life, but she wasn't really. She was having so many, you know, problems and anorexia, and, you know, she was battling that, and when you kind of know that and listen to this song, I feel like there's this layers of emotions and some more depth to it that, you know, she was always singing about positivity, but there's this bittersweetness to it. So I try to sing, you know, thinking about those deaths.
You're right. It does have that, doesn't it? It has a kind of melancholy.
Yes.
As well as being such a positive song.
Yeah. It's not just like, la, 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 no. Which is so, everything's amazing. But yeah, it's got the depth.
And she was a great drummer too, Karen Carpenter, I suppose. Does that impress you?
Yeah, she was, I love about her, like, she's just, she was so talented musically, and her voice just had that amazing pure quality to it, and the depth as well. Yeah, such a shame she passed away so quickly.
Well, we're going to play that song, but before we do, I want to let everyone know that you're performing Sound of Silence at Eurovision on May the 14th, so everyone can kind of barrack for you from here. And your new album, Classic Carpenters, is out now. Thank you so much, Dami, for coming in.
Oh, thanks for having
me. It's been really lovely to talk to you. And that is Dami Im. And we're going to go out with her track, her favourite track now. This is Close to You, an original Carpenters song.
Why do birds suddenly appear every time you are near? Just like me, they long to be close to you. Why do stars fall down from the sky every time walk by? Just like me, they long to be